Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Human Anatomy. And today is Tuesday, July 14th. So let's take a look at the schedule. Turn that down maybe just a little bit. All right, so where are we in the class right now? We're not looking too bad. So the 14th, we're going to get into peripheral nervous system, finish up central nervous system. So central nervous system is chapter 13, peripheral is 14. So we'll end today talking about things in chapter 14. And then this week, we're also going to cover autonomic nervous system, special senses. Next week, we're going to look at the endocrine chapter. And then right after that, on Tuesday of next week, is exam number 3. So don't forget, on exam number 3, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17 are on that lecture exam. And the nervous system chapter, central nervous system, is a little bit long. The others aren't too bad. But make sure that when you study for the exam, you get those exam study guides and pay attention to the page numbers that you're responsible for, right? So it's not all of chapter 13, but it's just these pages that are annotated on the syllabus, and those should be exactly the page numbers that are in the study guides, right? So that's what you should focus on. The other good advice is make sure you're familiar with endocrine system over the weekend or even now this week, right? Don't wait until Monday night to study endocrine system for the test on Tuesday, because I'm just not sure you'd be able to recall that information, right? So get an early start on that, and sooner the better, so that when I give a lecture on the endocrine system, it sort of makes sense, so that a lot of stuff just doesn't go right over your head because it's brand new. Right, that's what happens when something's brand new. All right, 1 week from today, exam number 3, and then on Wednesday of next week is the third practicum. And then after that, then you're 75% done with this class. So I suppose that's the good news, right, that this is ending pretty fast. Does anybody have a question over the syllabus schedule? You know, I forgot to mention one thing. Let's look at the lab schedule. So here is our lab schedule. We said today is the 14th, lab quiz number 5. So you're going to get that as we start lab today at 10, and that could be, it's going to be labeling the figure, and it could be either the anterior or the posterior view of muscles, the whole muscle diagram that's in your textbook, and I don't have the figure number in my mind, so I can't tell you which one it is. Yeah. The screens aren't going. Thank you. Let's see if we can get them working. Okay. Well, yeah, that's kind of a nasty trick because I have the lights off in here, so you probably can't even see your schedule that you have in front of you, and if it's not projecting, you can't see it up there either. Okay. But I think those things will start going pretty fast. So I'm just going to go back up here to lecture schedule. As the screens come on, good, they're coming on. Right, so today's the 14th. We're going to get into peripheral nervous system that I see right here. Right, and then that means 1 week from today, July 21st, exam number 3, right, that we see right here. Okay. Any other comments about what we're doing today? And now you can see everything. That is really nice. All right, I'll put the schedule away. We were looking at central nervous system, right? So let me go back up to the top, central nervous system. We got through lots of it, but we got to finish a couple things. Make sure you know these definitions of what a tract is, what a nucleus is, what a nerve is, all that kind of stuff. And we got down to spinal cord. So, I don't know, does that seem strange? Is spinal cord part of the central nervous system? Who knows? Spinal cord part of the central nervous system, or is it part of the peripheral nervous system? I think I saw a hand up there. I don't know, maybe you were just stretching, but I'm going to pick on you anyway. Spinal cord, is that central nervous system or peripheral nervous system? Yeah, central nervous system, right? Brain and spinal cord part of the central nervous system. That's just one of our basic definitions. Okay, and so we were looking at this illustration last time, which is an overview of the whole spinal cord. We can see that there are some enlargements in the cervical and lumbar region that supports our appendages because we have reflexes and other important kinds of controls in the spinal cord, which is central nervous system for appendages, so it takes more neurons to control those things. That's why the spinal cord is enlarged. Spinal cord only goes down to about the level of L2 because our body grows in height faster than our central nervous system can grow during development. And so the spinal cord doesn't fill. The whole vertebral canal stops at L2. And then there are nerves that go from L2 to where they exit. Right? And all those nerves in the vertebral canal we call the cauda equina, or horse's tail. The very centerpiece right here is the phylum terminale, and that is a ligament that puts traction on the spinal cord so that it doesn't retract up toward the brain, which might happen, and if it were to retract up to the brain, it would damage all of these nerves coming out of the vertebral column. So phylum terminale is important, but it could misbehave during development. Instead of producing this ligament, maybe the conus medullaris, which is the tip of the spinal cord, adheres to the sacrum or the coccyx, and then as somebody grows, then the spinal cord itself is stretched and damaged, and that is what we call, anybody remember what that's called? When the spinal cord is stretched and damaged because the conus medullaris is attached to the sacrum or coccyx, that's called a tethered cord. Cord as in spinal cord. Okay? All right, so hopefully that can be diagnosed very early on before there's a lot of damage to the spinal cord. All right, well, let's look at a nice cross-section of the spinal cord. Here's some pretty pictures. Oh, was that cauda equina? I never noticed that. Oh, yeah, look at that conus medullaris. Here's a real picture from a cadaver, and then here are all the nerves coming down within the vertebral column, and that's the cauda equina, and then look at how big this phylum terminale is. All right, so it's really nice, easily observable. Okay. We did talk about these curvatures. All right, so here is a section. And let's analyze this slide. What kind of section is this? Through the spinal cord. What kind of section? Anybody know? Go ahead, yell it out. No one else will hear you because everybody else is asleep. Go ahead, say what it is. So what are your choices? Sagittal, transverse, coronal. Which one is this? Okay, this is transverse, right? So we have to have a nice picture in our minds of what we're looking at. So let's go back to this picture here. If we have a transverse section, so transverse is like this, right? So the plane does not move superior inferiorly, right? It doesn't move anterior posteriorly, but it's just in a plane like you see the cursor moving in. So it's just a cut through the spinal cord that's nice and perpendicular to it, and we call that a transverse section, transverse plane. So that's one thing you should appreciate. The other thing, just as a review, what level of the vertebral column are we looking at? And it's really easy to see. Cervical, because of the transverse foramina and the bifid spinous process, right? So it's a nice cervical region. Okay, well, I see gray matter deep, and I see some white matter, which is superficial. Remember, white matter are myelinated axons, groups of thousands of myelinated axons going someplace. Think of it as a big cable carrying all kinds of information. If these are ascending tracts, they are sensory. If they're descending tracts, they are motor. All right, so sensory means bringing information into the central nervous system and brain, and motor means information leaving the brain and then leaving the spinal cord. All right, so these are tracts, and this gray matter are nerve cell bodies and axons that are non-myelinated. So it's going to look gray. All right, so you got white matter, gray matter. And what else do I see? Well, I see some membranes around the spinal cord, and then I see some spaces between the membranes. So here is a space between a membrane that's right on the surface of the spinal cord, which is what we call the pia mater. And I'm going to expand this so we can see a little bit better view even in the brain. These membranes extend all the way around the brain, not just spinal cord. So pia mater is a very thin membrane right on the surface of the neurons of the central nervous system. Then there is a space filled with cerebrospinal fluid. And you should know what kind of cells produce cerebrospinal fluid, and those are those ependymal cells that are neuroglia cells. And then another membrane called the arachnoid. And then the outermost or most superficial membrane is the dura mater. All right, and the function of the dura mater pretty much is in the name. So mater just means matter. Guess what dura means? Do you have anything that's dura? I might have some batteries in my transmitter here that are Duracell. What does dura mean? It means durable, toughest, right? The things that can protect the most or last the longest. So the dura mater is the toughest part of these membranes. These membrane systems are what we call meninges. The space between the arachnoid and the pia, that's the subarachnoid space. And remember, in subarachnoid space, that's where we have cerebrospinal fluid coming from those ependymal cells up in the brain. We're going to look at that pretty soon. Okay, then outside of the dura mater, but still within the vertebral canal, I see some adipose connective tissue. And since it is on top of the dura, guess what we would want to call that space? We call that the epidural space, right? And it's just adipose tissue. There aren't many nerves in this area, if any at all. There's probably a couple, but not highly innervated. It's not sensitive to anything. So this is a perfect place, right, to insert certain kinds of drugs. And if it's anesthetic, then a needle can insert anesthetic into this area right here, and that anesthetic will diffuse into the spinal cord, and then it will poison, or for just a period of time, maybe a short period of time, the nerve impulses that try to go across this level of the spinal cord. And so that's a really nice form of anesthesia, because everything below this level of the vertebral column, you won't be able to feel if there's like a painful operation or something. But that anesthetic, okay, will only have a local effect just on this part of the spinal cord. It will not have a systemic effect because it doesn't really get everywhere in your body. It doesn't affect your brain, right? It doesn't affect your heart. It doesn't affect your breathing, right? And as you know, anesthetics can be really dangerous. They can stop your heart. They can stop your breathing. And typically, this is used during delivery, because if you give a systemic anesthetic to a mom that's delivering, who else gets that anesthesia? The infant before they're born, right? And the dosing for infants and adults, as you can imagine, is totally different. So it's really tough to give an appropriate dose, systemic dose, to a mom and a child at the same time, unless there's some way that it's prevented from going across the placenta. Okay, so epidural space can be used as anesthesia. What do we call that kind of anesthesia? Maybe during delivery, when anesthetic is just injected into this epidural space, it's called an epidural, right? So it's just really simple. That's all tied together. Has anybody ever had an epidural in here for any reason? Raise your hand. Anybody have an epidural? Was it wonderful? No, it wasn't wonderful. Oh, why? Oh, yeah. Okay, so that's a really nice illustration, because remember, there are tracts that go up and tracts that go down, and so yeah, it anesthetized one of the wrong tracts, unfortunately. Okay, all right, well, I'm glad you were able to live through that okay. So it didn't affect your heart, didn't affect your respiration, it just didn't provide the relief that you would like to have had. Yeah, okay. Okay, the good news is that it didn't affect your baby. So that is really good news, right? Okay, so what about your experience with an epidural? Was it good? Bad? Way in the back? Did you say you had an epidural at one time? No? Okay. You're just stretching, maybe. All right, so that's where anesthesia is placed, in this epidural space. Okay, so this is central nervous system. When nerve fibers leave the spinal cord, right, on this particular text, they get a different color, and they look gold or yellow to me. Go ahead, tell me, what color are these things right here? Gold. So these nerves or axons leave the central nervous system, they leave the spinal cord, they get a different color, and so these right here are the beginnings of the peripheral nervous system. And we call these roots. So signals can either enter or leave the spinal cord via these roots. And I'll go over this again, probably a couple times. I see this root over here and one over here. How about this one right here? Is it anterior or posterior? Look at the vertebral body. What is the vertebral body? Anterior or posterior? Okay, vertebral body. Look at that skeleton in lab. You're going to see very obviously that it is anterior, right? And the spinous processes, go ahead, feel it right now. What about these spinous processes? Posterior, right? You can palpate those spinous processes on your back. All right, so this root is the anterior root. This one here is the posterior root. But you know what? No one hardly ever calls it that. They use a different nomenclature. So instead of anterior, you could call this the ventral. Ventral and anterior are the same. So this is the ventral root. And then here is not the posterior. It is a posterior. You could call it that. Everybody would know. But commonly, we would call this the dorsal root. Right? Dorsal root. Okay. Let's recall what the function of the lobes of the cerebrum are. What about the frontal lobe? You should be able to know, recall what the function of the frontal lobe is compared to the parietal. Frontal lobe. Motor, I heard it, motor, like the motor in your car, which what initiates contraction of skeletal muscle, that is on the anterior side. So the architecture of the spinal cord follows the same architecture of the brain. So if the anterior part of the brain, you believe that the frontal lobe is anterior? Frontal lobe anterior? Yeah. So the anterior part of the spinal cord is going to be mostly motor because it matches up with the frontal lobe, the function of the frontal lobe. And same thing for this ventral root. This ventral root is motor. And it's 100%. So signals leave the central nervous system via the ventral root. Right? There are no signals ever that enter the CNS via the ventral root. So ventral is 100% motor. Right? Well, signals have to get in to the spinal cord. How do signals get in if they can't get in via the ventral root? They enter via the dorsal root. Dorsal root is 100% sensory. What's another name for sensory? Another name for sensory is afferent, right? So the dorsal root is 100% afferent. The ventral root is 100% efferent. Okay. All right, so we got these roots right here. We got the columns. We got the gray matter. Nice. Let's look at another slide. Oh, this just shows the three layers of the meninges, the dura mater, the arachnoid, the pia mater, right on the surface of the spinal cord. Here we have a canal running through the center of the spinal cord. Conveniently, that's called the central canal. And in the gray matter, it has different points or projections, and these are what we call horns. So this one here is the anterior horn, right? Or you could say ventral horn. And then here is a lateral horn, and here is a posterior or dorsal horn. Okay, so that's the gray matter. Nerve cell bodies, dendrites, and unmyelinated axons. These areas, the white areas where we have columns, remember most columns that are ventral are motor, most columns that are dorsal are sensory. It's not always 100% that way, but that's a pretty good guess. There are groups of neurons depending on what kind of tracts they belong to, and they form columns, bunches of nerves forming columns. Another name for a column is a funiculus. And I can't see the columns right here very well, okay, because it hasn't been stained for that. So we're going to call this area of white matter in the spinal cord, right, the ventral funiculus, or you could call it columns. Here is lateral, and then here is dorsal funiculus. Funiculus is white matter. So these are myelinated axons going someplace. So in a transverse section of the spinal cord, you have horns, right, you have funiculi, and then you have a communication from the right to the left side of the brain. These are commissural fibers, right? Commissural fibers share information from right to left. And this is what we call the gray commissure because it has commissural fibers. This is some way that information can be shared from one side of the body to the other. Not through this area because look at this depression right here that we call the median fissure, ventral median fissure. There are no axons that can move across that fissure. And the same thing for this posterior, the dorsal median sulcus, right? Signals can't get across. The only way they can get across is through the gray commissure. I think I want to point something else out that has to do with the peripheral nervous system. Right, so we're looking at central nervous system, the spinal cord, and we can see some nerves leaving the spinal cord, which means that they become part of the peripheral nervous system. All of these little nerves right here are what we call rootlets. Right, the rootlets all converge together to make a root. So here is these are ventral rootlets. They converge to make the ventral root, and then the ventral root converges with what root is this over here? This is the dorsal root. So when ventral and dorsal roots join together, that forms a spinal nerve. So here's a spinal nerve. And this is the thing that exits through that intervertebral foramen between vertebrae. Okay. And then I see some other projections. I see this one and this large one. These are what we call rami because, look, it's making like a 90-degree bend from the spinal nerve. And if this is a ramus, no, it's not labeled on this slide. Oh, that's good because this chapter is talking about central nervous system. Right, this would be the posterior ramus, and here would be the anterior, or you could say dorsal or ventral ramus. So where is your spinal cord located in your body? Is it right smack in the middle? Is it more anterior or more posterior in your body? Yeah, it's more posterior, right? Okay, so where do you have the majority of your body? Is it in front of the spinal cord, anterior to the spinal cord, or posterior to the spinal cord? Where is most of your body located? Yeah, most of it is anterior to the spinal cord, right? And that's why this ramus over here is a lot bigger because it has to cover a lot more volume, a lot more tissues. And this ventral ramus is relatively small because you don't have a lot of your body that is posterior to your vertebral column, right? So this ramus is small because you don't have a lot of volume or tissue behind the vertebral column. The ventral ramus is large because that's where most of your body, right, exists. It is anterior to the spinal cord or vertebral column. Okay, so this probably is an exam figure. So what do you need to know? Meninges. Dura mater, arachnoid mater, pia mater, and then the funiculi and the horns, dorsal horns, and probably these roots. And we're going to take a look at this thing. Here is a swelling in the dorsal root. This is a group of nerve cell bodies right here, and these are from sensory neurons, nerve cell bodies from sensory neurons group right in this area. So what do we call a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? That was a definition, a group of, it's just a collection of nerve cell bodies from neurons in the peripheral nervous system. That's a ganglion. It can be in different locations. This one is very close to the central nervous system, but nonetheless, it's peripheral. So this is what we call the dorsal root, right, because it's in the dorsal root, ganglion. It's a group of nerve cell bodies from sensory neurons. Remember, the dorsal root is 100% sensory or afferent. Can you remember what type of neuron by structure is sensory? What kind of neuron is sensory? Always going to be a sensory neuron if you see it by its shape. Okay? It is a unipolar or pseudo-unipolar. All right? And that's what I see right here. The nerve cell body is here. There's a small projection that comes down right here. Then it bifurcates into the peripheral process that goes out to the periphery. And the other part of that bifurcation is a process of that neuron that goes into the central nervous system, and we would call that the central process. All right, so I can't see it on here, but I can imagine that it's inside that tissue right there. Okay. All right, so that's pretty good for spinal cord. So I covered all of this stuff. Sensory and motor pathways, covered all that. Let's look at a couple of tracts. So a tract, a tract, a tract. Ah, here's a tract. All right, what are we looking at here? I see cerebrum, right? And I even see some more cerebrum. And I see midbrain. And then I see medulla, so that's still part of the brain. Then I see spinal cord here and here. Can you kind of picture that, all these different transverse sections? This one here looks more like a coronal section of the brain. And this is a view of the spinothalamic tract or pathway. Probably I would like for you to say tract, spinal, but it has more than just tract. It even has this nucleus right here. So pathway probably is good. All right, so spinothalamic. Here's some important nomenclature. Here is an O. What does that O signify in anatomy? It means that two different things get joined together, like sternocleidomastoid muscle, right? Okay, so what is being joined together here? Spine and thalamus. You know where the spinal cord is, you know where the thalamus is. So here is a pathway that involves the spine and the thalamus. And just like in muscles, the first part of the name of a muscle sometimes is the origin, and the last part is the insertion. Same thing when we name tracts. The first part of the name of a tract is the origination or the origin of the tract. The second part of the name of a pathway or a tract is the destination. So where does this pathway take information? From the spinal cord to the thalamus. And can you see the thalamus right here? Okay. I think in a little bit you'll be able to see that this is the thalamus. So which way are signals moving? If they're going from the spinal cord to the thalamus, ascending or descending? It's ascending. And what can you tell me about ascending? Sensory or motor? It's a sensory, 100% sensory, or afferent. So this is an afferent pathway. And so this is pretty handy because, remember, we said that the job of the thalamus was to act as a relay station for sending signals to the proper places of the cerebral cortex for your appreciation. This is where you appreciate reality. Not in the medulla, not in the spinal cord, but that information has to reach the cerebral cortex. And it does so by passing through the thalamus. All right, so this is sensory. What lobe in your brain is sensory? Is it frontal or parietal? What was that frontal lobe? We said it was motor. Okay, so it can't be the frontal lobe, so that means it's the parietal lobe. So these neurons are moving from the thalamus to different locations in the parietal lobe, and that region right here is what we call the primary somatosensory cortex. Somato means that it comes from the surface of your body, like your skin, right? And hypodermis, maybe some muscles. All right, so how many nerves does it take to get from a sensation in some part of your periphery, like the bottom of your foot, to the cerebral cortex? All right, so you have, okay, here's your foot. We put a match underneath it. What is this match right here in terms of a response loop? Or, and this is just the first part of a response loop, what is this right here? This is a stimulus, right? The match is a stimulus. In order for you to appreciate this match, what do you have to have? What's the second thing in a response loop? A receptor. So here's the stimulus. You have receptors in your foot that can feel that burning sensation. And the burning sensation then enters the central nervous system via a afferent neuron. So here is the first neuron, and can you see that this is just a nice unipolar neuron? Here's the cell body, here's that single process coming off, and then it bifurcates into a peripheral process and a central process that enters the spinal cord via the dorsal root, right? And so here is the first, so we might want to call this the first order neuron. It enters the spinal cord and stimulates a second order neuron that goes all the way up through the spinal cord, through the medulla brainstem, to the thalamus, where it ends. Okay, and then it synapses on the tertiary neuron or third order neuron that takes it to the cerebral cortex for your appreciation, right? And that's relatively fast, but it's not instantaneous. So you don't have the perception of tissue damage the exact same time that your tissue starts to become damaged, right? There's a little bit of a delay, even though these signals are traveling at hundreds of miles an hour. Still takes a little time to get up there. That's going to be an important point. So here is the spinal thalamic tract. You should appreciate that is an afferent pathway, and that originates in the spinal cord, goes to the thalamus. The thalamus is a nice relay station for sending signals to the different parts of the parietal lobe, and those regions are what we call the primary somatosensory. Somato referring to something not deep inside a body cavity, more on the surface of your body. Is a good way to understand that. All right, so that's an ascending tract, and I only want you to know one example of an ascending tract, and I also want you to know one example of a descending tract. Okay? And here is one example. You don't have to become familiar with the pyramidal. You know, probably sooner or later you might have to. Let's look at this other one that's on this illustration, which is the corticospinal pathway. So when you look at the name, corticospinal, you should be able to tell what kind of pathway that is. Is it motor or sensory? Motor, because the first part of the word is cortex, the second part of the word is spine. So here are signals going from the brain into the spinal cord. All right, so this is a descending tract. All right, so here is a nice coronal section through the brain, and these tracts are taking information from the brain into the spinal cord and then into the periphery. Is this an afferent or efferent pathway if information is descending through the spinal cord? Yeah, it's efferent. It's a motor pathway, right? And you should know what lobe of the brain is responsible for motor activity, controlling skeletal muscles, voluntary control. What part of the brain is that? We talked about already. That is the frontal lobe, right? So here is the frontal lobe, and here's the nerve cell body. And it looks like this nerve cell body is placed in this gray matter, the cortical gray matter of the cerebrum. Does that make sense? That the cell body is up here in the gray matter? What can you tell me about the nature of a cell body in dendrites that makes it look gray? It's non-myelinated. Yeah, so this illustration is pretty nice. It adheres to our understanding, right? Here's a nerve cell body. It's in gray matter because it is gray looking. Doesn't have myelin, right? And then here's the axon. Axon is myelinated, so then this forms white matter inside the brain. Here's the axon that continues to descend through the internal capsule between the thalamus here and the basal nuclei. And then it goes down into the medulla. And take a look at this. It crosses over to the other side of the spinal cord, right? And so when something crosses over, we call that decussation. And when things cross over, they kind of make a little cross hatch thing, so there's a lot of pointy parts to it. And if you look at it just right, it looks like little pyramids sticking out right here. So these are what we call decussation of the pyramids, where nerve axons cross over to the other side of the spinal cord and then descend through a motor tract. All right, so it takes one neuron to go all the way from the cerebral cortex down to the level of the spinal cord where that signal is going to go. And then here's an interneuron. Here's a second neuron, which will stimulate an efferent motor neuron going to a skeletal muscle, right? Because this is the primary motor cortex, this information is not going to smooth muscle or cardiac muscle, right? The effector organ is going to be skeletal muscle voluntary control. So this is the part of the brain that you use to contract these muscles all over the body. And how does that motor signal leave the spinal cord? What route does it leave? What route does it leave the spinal cord? And you can see it on here, if you can remember the name of this route. This is the ventral route. Here's the dorsal route, right? So ventral route is 100% motor every single time. What about this dorsal route? Yeah, it's going to be sensory. And what about that previous slide? Is that what we saw right here? There's this match. What route does it go in? The dorsal route, right? Motor always leaves the ventral route. So that's one way you could tell this is a motor pathway, because look at that nerve. It's leaving the ventral route, not the dorsal route. All right, so motor signals 100% of the time are going to leave the ventral route. One way that I can remember that is, for some reason, this dorsal root ganglia always sticks in my mind. Dorsal root ganglia. And the dorsal root ganglia is located where? In the ventral root or dorsal root? It's going to be the dorsal root, right? So it's part of the name. That's a nice key. The other way that I can remember this, okay, even if I don't give a lecture probably for 20 years, I'll be able to remember it, because here is dorsal, which has a nice S in it, and sensory also has a nice S in it, matches up. The ventral root has a letter in it that is, it shares with motor. And what letter is that? Ventral and motor. what letter is shared with those two words? T, right? Motor. There's a T in motor. There's a T in ventral. It kind of lines up that way. Maybe you guys don't remember things like that, but sometimes it helps me, right? Might help you, but probably you should never tell anybody that your anatomy instructor told you to remember something like that, okay? Because it's kind of silly, but if it helps for the test, go ahead and use that technique. All right, so spinal thalamic tract, cortical spinal tract, you should be able to tell me which one is motor, which one is sensory. All right, reflexes we talked about. But this list kind of mirrors the list that's in your book, and it's missing two things. What does a reflex arc always start with? A stimulus. And what does it always end with? A response, right? So what kind of structure in your body can appreciate a stimulus? It's got to be a receptor. And what kind of tissue in your body will produce a response? It has to be an effector, right? So an effector always produces a response, and a receptor, right, senses whatever the stimulus is, and then, of course, here are the pieces that are in between. Okay, we talked about the meninges already, but let me show you a really nice exam figure of meninges. Holy cow, I don't have it open. Okay, let me go find a nice picture of the meninges, the exam figure, the exam figure for meninges, PNS, central nervous system. The good exam figure of meninges is right here. Okay, so here's the skull, and I can see the cerebrum, right, which is very superior. We're looking at a very superior aspect of the cerebrum. Here is that longitudinal fissure that separates the hemispheres. So let's zoom into this region right here. And I see it. So what are we familiar with? The gray matter in the cerebral cortex, right? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites. White matter that contains myelinated axons going someplace. What do we call myelinated axons in the central nervous system? Myelinated axons, we call that white matter. Looks like white. What do we call nerve cell bodies and dendrites in the central nervous system? Gray matter, right? And it looks gray. All right, and then here are the bones. So this probably could be the frontal bone, the posterior part of the frontal bone, maybe parietal bone, doesn't matter, but somewhere in that area. Here you have, let's look at some layers. Skin, right, of the scalp. And then you have the membrane that surrounds that bone, the parietal bone, let's just say. I think it doesn't matter. Yeah, parietal bone. What's the name of the membrane that surrounds the outside of a bone? That is the periosteum, that's a layer. Then here is the bone itself, and you can see compact bone, spongy bone, sometimes we call that diploid. And then here is some more compact bone or cortical bone on the inside surface or deep surface. And then another membrane. Okay, and what's a membrane that usually we think of that is on the inside of a bone? We call that the endosteum, right? So there's endosteum in there. But then on the outside of the bone, here is that membrane. What do we call a membrane on the outside of a bone once again? It is the periosteum, right? So there's another layer of periosteum here, but this is deep inside the cranium. So it's a little bit different than the one on the outside. And it's not really continuous. So these two membranes, even though they're on the surface of this bone, they're pretty much different. This is what we call the periosteal layer of the membrane that is the toughest one that surrounds the brain. What do we call that toughest membrane that surrounds the brain? It is the dura mater. So the dura mater's got two parts. It's got the periosteal division that's right on the surface, inside surface of the bone. Then here is that really tough layer, the meningeal layer that has a lot of collagen, right? And if it is loaded with collagen, what can you tell me about the dura mater? Even by looking at the name, it tells you. It is tough and durable, right? Really, really tough. Okay, so that's the first layer of the meninges. Then we have the arachnoid membrane. Then the subarachnoid space. What do we have in the subarachnoid space? Anybody remember? Subarachnoid space is filled with cerebrospinal fluid. And then the membrane that lines every little gyrus and sulcus on the surface of the cortex, that's what we call the pia mater. All right, so these are the three layers of the meninges. Pia, arachnoid, and dura mater. And dura is the toughest. The arachnoid is sort of interesting because right below it is the subarachnoid space with cerebral spinal fluid, and then here's the pia right on the surface of the brain. So there is, and I don't see any tissue that's producing cerebral spinal fluid on this illustration, but we're going to see it pretty soon. Right, this cerebral spinal fluid should not accumulate in the brain. It's sort of like plasma. It's very similar to plasma. And there is a flow pattern. Cerebral spinal fluid is produced inside the brain from blood, and then it's returned to the blood, which is good because otherwise your brain would swell up, right? And that would be terrible because your brain has no place to go when it swells up because it's contained within the cranial vault. That would compress all the brain tissue, cause nerve damage. So the way it's returned to the cardiovascular system is via these arachnoid granulations, or sometimes they're called villi. So here's a villus and here's a villus. Cerebral spinal fluid passes through this membrane back into this blue space right here, and this is basically a vein that's going to take blood back to the heart, and it's right on midline. So it's a sagittal sinus, and it's right on the top of the brain, so it is one of the more superior sinuses in the brain. So this is the superior sagittal sinus, and these granulations right here return cerebral spinal fluid back to your blood, which then goes back to your heart, and that just helps protect the volume inside the cranium. All right, so these are what I want you to see for layers of the meninges. There are some tougher layers of dura mater. Here we see some dura mater moving between the cerebral hemispheres. That's what we call the falx cerebri. And it's only in the longitudinal fissure. I can see it over here. Here's a nice sagittal view of the brain. Here is the falx cerebri separating the cerebral hemispheres. There's also a similar layer between the occipital lobe and the cerebellum. That's called the falx cerebelli. So I can see the falx cerebelli right here, and then here is the falx cerebri. These are important dividers of the brain. Okay, that's pretty good. Let's look at cerebral spinal fluid a little bit more. It's produced by choroid plexus. So let's take a look at choroid plexus. It's within a ventricle in the brain. I tell you what, let's look at a ventricle inside the brain first. Okay, so let's get oriented. Here is the cerebrum, all right? And here's the cerebellum, spinal cord, medulla, and pons. And these blue areas right here represent spaces that are deep inside the brain. And these spaces are what we call ventricles. Sometimes a ventricle is a cavity inside something. The heart has ventricles, which is a big cavity inside the heart. And they have kind of a weird shape. I will agree with that. But the naming of these things is fairly easy. They're just named. These right here are not on midline. We call these the lateral ventricles. They used to be called number one and number two. They're no longer called that, but they're called the lateral ventricle because they're way off midline. And they have choroid plexus in them, which produces CSF, which stands for cerebrospinal fluid. That fluid then moves through this little foramen, right, from the lateral ventricle into the third, because remember, lateral used to be one and two, so here's the third traveling through this interventricular foramen. Then CSF moves through this little canal. We saw this when we looked at the midbrain. This is the cerebral aqueduct between the cerebral peduncle and the corpora quadrigemina. And then CSF enters the next ventricle, which is the fourth ventricle between the medulla, pons, and cerebellum is right here. And then that CSF moves into the central canal of the spinal cord, which we saw not too long ago. If we look at this in a lateral view, I can see the lateral ventricles, right, then the interventricular foramen, emptying CSF into the third ventricle through the cerebral aqueduct into the fourth ventricle. So this fourth ventricle is pretty wide from left to right, but from anterior to posterior, it is really thin. And we got some pretty good models in lab that will show you that. All right, so those are the ventricles. These ventricles are pretty important because that cerebrospinal fluid is inside the brain, but it's also on the outside of the brain. It's a fluid. And what happens to something when we put it in fluid? Like you jump into a swimming pool, okay? And so let's have a scale, all right? And on the deck of the swimming pool, you weigh yourself and you get a certain number. And then we put the scale in the pool, right? And then you jump in the pool and you weigh yourself again, okay? Will that number be the same if you weigh yourself when you're in water or compared to when you're not in water? When you're floating in water, how much would that scale measure? Not very much at all, right? So that water helps reduce your weight, right? It helps give you some buoyancy, and that's one of the jobs of cerebrospinal fluid, right? It kind of floats the brain and the cranium so that it doesn't crush itself. That's pretty cool. Right, the other thing that the cerebrospinal fluid does is that when there's trauma to the skull and then to the brain, because it goes right through the cranium, this helps distribute some of that shock so that one area of the brain doesn't receive all of that trauma. And if you were to look at a football helmet, a modern football helmet that's being made today, you will notice that those helmets have chambers in them filled with fluid, some water, some air, and so the outer shell of the helmet absorbs the shock, and the fluid chambers redistributes that shock so that no part, and no single part of somebody's head or brain receives all of that trauma. All right, football helmets have that. Probably some other helmets might have that, but I haven't seen that yet. Okay, so that's two important functions of that cerebrospinal fluid. Okay, and it has some other functions. Here's a nice anterior view. Here's that lateral view. And let me look and see if I can find a flow pattern that we want to talk about. Probably right here. Okay, so here we have a nice sagittal section of the brain. And so I can see the cerebrum, right? I can see the pons and the medulla, cerebellum. Here is the midbrain that has the cerebral peduncle and the corpora quadra gemina. And right between them is the cerebral aqueduct. Superior to the cerebral aqueduct is the third ventricle. And below it is the fourth ventricle. Lateral ventricles you can't really see because they're not on midline. Right? Maybe you can see about where they would be on this illustration. And here's the corpus callosum. It has those commissural tracts in it carrying information from the right to the left side of the cerebral hemisphere, so the right side of your brain knows what the left side is experiencing or thinking. Okay, so here is a part of the lateral ventricle. At least the artist sort of drew it in right here. And then this dark stuff, does it look red to you at all? Pink? What color does this look like? Does it have a color? Is there enough there for you to tell what color that is? Who can tell me what color that is? Red. Okay. This red area here is what we call choroid plexus. It has ependymal cells and blood vessels, capillaries in particular, and that the structure, the choroid plexus, can take plasma and manufacture cerebrospinal fluid. All right, so here we have cerebrospinal fluid in the lateral ventricle, moves through this interventricular foramen into the third ventricle. I can see a nice thalamus here and hypothalamus. So the third ventricle is right on the inside of the thalamus, between the lobes of the thalamus and the walls of the hypothalamus. And on the roof of the third ventricle, there is more choroid plexus, which makes even more cerebrospinal fluid, which then flows through this cerebral aqueduct into the fourth ventricle. And what do you find in the fourth ventricle? Even more choroid plexus that makes cerebrospinal fluid. Right, and then that CSF can either move out of the ventricle through these little apertures that I don't stress in this particular class, or down the central canal, and it enters the subarachnoid space, which we looked at, and then it makes its way back up to that superior sagittal sinus, okay, and it goes through this arachnoid granulation into that sinus, and then it's returned to the heart. All right, so here is a flow pattern. So this material, cerebrospinal fluid, does flow. through your brain, produced by choriplexus, return to the cardiovascular system or the blood via this arachnoid granulation. Sometimes an individual one is called a villus, arachnoid villus. So that's a pretty important thing. So if there's a blockage in any of these places, like this interventricular foramen or the cerebral aqueduct, then cerebrospinal fluid is going to accumulate inside the brain, right? And these ventricles are going to get bigger and bigger and bigger and actually compress the brain tissue, right? And that would be terrible when that happens. And I think I have a picture. Oh, here is what makes up the choriplexus. You can see a capillary, right? You can see the ependymal cells. And the choriplexus takes plasma, makes CSF out of it. And what does it do? It contains glucose and some oxygen and various ions. These are important electrolytes for nerve activity, vitamins, and an energy source like glucose. So this is a little bit different than plasma, but kind of similar to plasma. And if there's a blockage of any of those passageways during development, this is what happens. Okay. So here's a typical picture of what blockage of ventricle would look like. And today, right, with proper prenatal care, this can be diagnosed very early, and surgery can be done on the fetal brain before it's born, which is really cool. And so what happens then is that a shunt or tube is placed, depending on where the blockage is, from the ventricle into another part of the brain, or maybe into a vein, like a subclavian vein, or jugular vein, which is below the head, which then drains the cerebral spinal fluid, stops compressing the brain, and then the fetal brain can develop normally instead of being damaged. So that's pretty cool stuff. Okay, so that's the flow pattern, and so I think this is an exam figure, and that's it for central nervous system. So what are the important things? The different parts of the central nervous system, the different lobes, right, the midbrain, what makes up the midbrain, some functions of the midbrain, medulla and pons, which is the brainstem, some functions of the brainstem, spinal cord, different layers of the spinal cord, what their functions are, roots, right, and some tract information or pathways are important, and then meninges is important to know too, right, the layers that surround the spinal cord and the brain as well. So those are all some things that you should become familiar with. Oh, look, I have a couple numbers right here. What does choriplexus produce once again? Let's see if anybody's awake. Choriplexus produces cerebrospinal fluid, right? And it makes about 500 mLs a day, which is what, half of a liter. And so that has to be returned to the blood. Otherwise, your brain would swell up by half a liter every single day. And It couldn't do that, right, without maintaining health of the brain. So that has to be returned. That's a large volume. Okay. All right, so that's it for central nervous system. So I get to put some of these things away. Unless you have a question. Anybody have a question? Ventricles, meninges, parts of the brain, any of that kind of stuff? We're pretty good with that. Okay. Well, who can tell me what's next? What is next? Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? Not that one. This one. Peripheral nervous system. How would you tell somebody where to look for the peripheral nervous system? Where is the peripheral nervous system located? Every nervous tissue that is outside the brain and spinal cord is peripheral nervous system. So I think of that as being pretty simple. Okay, what happened? Let me go back. Peripheral nervous system. Ah, right here. Okay. All right, so let's talk about the organization of the peripheral nervous system. Well, just like we saw in the central nervous system, there are afferent and efferent areas. Right there, we can use that same designation for peripheral nervous system. So sensory is carrying signals from periphery to CNS. What's another name for sensory? Afferent. And then motor, another name for motor is efferent, right? And some other divisions of the sensory nerves. We have somatic, which is on the surface of your body, right? Skin, body wall, limbs, which is different than visceral. Visceral, you should think of things deep inside body cavities. That's visceral. That's a good way to understand, appreciate a little distinction between somatic and visceral. And motor can be broken down the same way into somatic and visceral. And if it's motor, motor. Here's a somatic motor system. It's going to things on the surface of your body, not deep inside body cavities. What is the one thing that you can control in your body that is not contained inside a body cavity? It's contained in what we call the soma, the somatic region of your body. What is that voluntary effector organ that you have control of? Yeah, skeletal muscle, right? So somatic or voluntary, the effector organ is skeletal muscle. There are three other types of effector organs in your body that you cannot control. It's controlled automatically for you. So what are some other effector organs that can produce a response in your body? How about smooth muscle? How about cardiac muscle? And also glands, right? You can't control glands. They are controlled by the autonomic nervous system. So motor can be broken down to somatic, which goes to skeletal muscle. Visceral and autonomic sort of are synonymous. Okay, they go to smooth muscle, cardiac muscle, and glands. Most of this tissue is inside a body cavity. Okay, so we don't call that the somatic part. So that's a functional organization. In terms of a structural organization, there are nerves. There has to be ways that information enters, and in order for you to perceive things in your environment or even inside your body, you have to have receptors. Right? So you have peripheral sensory receptors, and also, since you have skeletal muscle, there has to be motor nerves that go down there that have motor endings, like the neuromuscular junction. And the way that information leaves the central nervous system is via nerve, and we can break those areas down into nerves that leave the brain and nerves that leave the spinal cord. Nerves that leave the brain are what we call cranial nerves. Cranial nerves leave the brain. Nerves that leave the spinal cord are what we call spinal nerves. I don't have a really pretty slide that shows that, only individually. All right, so let me show you some cranial nerves. So here's the brain. Here are some nerves that are leaving the brain. If these are nerves that are leaving the brain, what do we call these nerves? As a group, they are cranial nerves. Okay, and then spinal cord. Let's see if I can find something down in the spinal cord. I can see nerves leaving the spinal cord. What would we call nerves leaving this? Oh, look at this right here. Okay, what do we call these nerves right here that are leaving? So here's the ventral root, that's a motor. Here's a nerve that's leaving the central nervous system. And I can see the vertebral column. So what kind of nerve is that, a cranial or spinal nerve? That's got to be a spinal nerve, right? So here's a spinal nerve. Spinal nerve, right, is made up of this dorsal root and ventral root when they join together. So here's a spinal nerve. Okay, it just so happens there are 12 pairs of cranial nerves that arise from the brain. That's going to be an important number for you to know, 12, because you're going to have to know the names of those cranial nerves. And it's not so important that you know that there are 31 pairs of spinal nerves, but that is nice for comparison. You have basically three times as many spinal nerves as you do cranial nerves because your vertebral column is a lot longer. Okay, so for sensation, you need to have a receptor. And receptors can be free nerve endings, right? And free nerve endings are good for temperature sensation and also pain sensation. Then there's some special receptor types of cells for vibration and pressure, like Pacinian corpuscles that you've run into, Meissner's corpuscles, right, Merkel's discs and things like that. So those are a couple ways that we can characterize receptors, right? Some simple ones that are free nerve endings, some are a little bit more complicated that have specialized receptor cells. We can also classify receptors by their location. So we have receptors that can appreciate stimulus outside of our body, in the environment. These are what we call exteroreceptors, like touch, pressure, pain, temperature, and most of these special senses, like for vision, hearing, are what we call exteroreceptors. They're sensing things outside of our body. But our central nervous system should be aware of things that are happening inside our body as well, like maybe glucose concentration, right? Water balance, blood pressure, all of that kind of stuff. Those are sensed by interoceptors as opposed to exteroceptors. These things can measure things like hunger, fulfillment when you eat something, thirst, okay, and even pain, right? If you have damage to a tissue deep inside your body, you might be able to sense that pain. Sometimes you can't, like there are no pain receptors in your brain whatsoever, but other organs do, and it produces a different kind of pain that we call visceral pain. It just has a totally different kind of sensation. Somatic pain from these receptors is very sharp and acute, right, and very objectionable. Visceral pain is kind of dull, but it is just as objectionable, right? But it just has a different nature to it. It's hard to localize where the pain is coming from, but it can be very persistent and debilitating, just like somatic pain can be. And another kind of receptor, proprioceptors, and these proprioceptors are in muscles and they're in joints. So they have to do with your musculoskeletal system. They send information to the brain as to where your body is positioned and how your muscles are working. What's the angulation on joints? So even with your eyes closed, right, I could take your hand and place it above your head with your eyes closed, and you could tell me where your hand was, right, because of proprioception. You just have the sense of where your body parts are because there are special receptors for tension, right, and stretch that are in every muscle and every joint in your body. Those are proprioceptors. Sometimes we can classify stimulus by the nature of it, like a mechanoreceptor for pressure and vibration. There are receptors that can sense temperature, thermoreceptors, receptors that can measure like glucose concentration in your blood to help maintain blood glucose concentration. These are chemoreceptors. Ooh, what's that disease process called when a person can't regulate their blood glucose concentration? And that might be due to these malfunction of chemoreceptors here. But what do we call that? And is it a prevalent disease these days? What disease? Name of a disease when a person can't regulate their blood glucose concentration. That is diabetes. That's right. Diabetes mellitus, there are different kinds. Physiology, you get to learn something about the different kinds, but it's a very serious disease. And if you know anybody with diabetes, then you should really help them be compliant, because somebody with diabetes doesn't really feel like they're sick. But what are some of the consequences when somebody has uncontrolled diabetes? Is it serious consequence, even though you kind of feel okay? Well, one consequence is blindness. Another consequence is kidney failure. Another consequence is heart failure. So are those serious conditions? Yeah, produced by diabetes. And so diabetes is a really serious disease process, and you should help people out that you know that have diabetes as much as you can, because sometimes people suffering from diabetes kind of like to ignore it, right? But it can't be ignored because it's fatal if that doesn't happen. But it's actually worse than fatal because you lose parts of your body as you die, right? It'd be okay if you just died all of a sudden, but diabetes is not like that. You die a piece at a time, right? So that's kind of terrible. Other receptors, we kind of talked about these, encapsulated, non-encapsulated, proprioceptors. We have muscle spindles and muscle. We have Golgi tendon organs and tendons, so muscle spindles for stretch, and Golgi tendon organs for tension, and then we might have some other kinds of proprioceptors in other parts of our body that are modifications of spindles and tendon organs for measuring things like position or acceleration, maybe even for pain. Okay, innervation of skeletal muscle. Well, motor. I think we looked at this already, a motor unit. right, is a single neuron, somatic motor neuron, going to a skeletal muscle, and it's going to bifurcate as it gets into the muscle, and each individual muscle cell will receive part of that neuron, the signal from that neuron, right? So a motor unit is composed of one motor neuron and the number of individual muscle cells that it innervates. That is what we call a motor unit. So like the biceps brachii does not have one nerve fiber going to it, right? It has many. And so it has many motor units, and that's why you can contract the biceps weakly to pick up an object that's very light, or you can contract all the fibers in your biceps to pick up a weight that's really, really heavy, right? By recruiting different motor units. And that synapse, what is a synapse? What is one way that I would like for you to think of a synapse? It's a structural and functional unit, and it's a structural and functional unit of what? Like, what's the structural and functional unit of life? Cell. Structural and functional unit of contraction. Sarcomere. And a synapse is a structural and functional unit of communication between cells. Communication between cells. So synapse is a special kind of unit that allows cells to communicate with each other. That's a synapse. And the neuromuscular junction is a special kind. We call it a chemical synapse. So the way information is transmitted from one neuron to the next is via a chemical. Can anybody remember the general name of a chemical that's used for cells to communicate with each other? Say from a neuron to another neuron. It's transmitting information. That's right. And it's coming from a neuron, so it's called a neurotransmitter. Numerous kinds of neurotransmitters. I think we talked about some last time. One of the most prevalent is called ACH. And what does ACH stands for? Acetylcholine. Yeah, acetylcholine is used at all neuromuscular junctions and many other places in your nervous system and central nervous system. Okay, so that's an important neurotransmitter. There's also something that is important, and that is, once a signal is transmitted from one cell to the next, then that system should be reset so that another signal can be sent, right? And so something has to break down acetylcholine so that a cell can receive another signal, and that is called acetylcholinesterase. This ACE right here means that it's an enzyme that's breaking something down. And if that is not functioning, if acetylcholinesterase is not functioning, then that junction then is prevented from working ever again. So think of a synapse as maybe being like that light switch on the wall, right? And if there is acetylcholinesterase, right, you can turn the switch on, you can turn the switch off, but at a later time, what can you do? You can turn it on, you can turn it off, on and off all the time. But without acetylcholinesterase in a synapse, what would happen to that switch once you turned it on? You'd never be able to turn it off. And if you can't turn it off, then you can't turn it back on again, right? So it's those change in states that are very important. And that's what acetylcholinesterase is important for. Okay, maybe on this slide I have some other examples of neurotransmitters. Norepinephrine, here's one. Okay, and so we're going to look at that when we get into autonomic nervous system. That's broken down by another enzyme, and sometimes we just call that MAO, not acetylcholinesterase. All right, well, let's look at some anatomy, but we can't because class is over. We're going to start next time. Maybe in lab we'll start talking about some of these cranial nerves, but probably not lab because you got to look at a lot of muscles today. All right, cranial nerves. But before you go, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet, and also tell me before you leave the room, you got to tell me this before you leave, otherwise I can't let you leave ever. Where do cranial nerves come from? Cranial nerves, where do they come from? Two choices, spinal cord or brain. So is it brain or spinal cord? Brains. That's right. Cranial nerves come from the brain, and you have 12 pairs of them, and we're going to be familiar with their names, their number, and a little bit about their function, because it's pretty important. Okay, does everybody know where the sign-in sheet is? It's going to eventually find its way back down here. Soon. I've been pretty lucky and diligent getting these lectures online, in case you want to listen to them online again. So probably the same with this one too.